Monster Man, episode 463, Troglodyte and Troll. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we are returning to Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition, and we're going to take a look at two monsters, one of which has changed a little bit from 1st Edition, but I think in a very interesting way. Before we do that, though, it's time to thank some new Patreon backers. Yes, these are people who've gone to patreon.com/monsterman, and they have pledged as little as $1 a month to help support the show. And if, like today's backers, you pledge at the $2 or higher level, you'll also get access to my other podcast, Patron Deities. So thank you very much to returning patron, Brian Orban, and new patrons, Michael Brewer, Eric Surin, James Knight, and Spuzz. And Eric, sorry about that. If you'd like to support the show without becoming a patron, one thing that you could do that would be really useful would be to leave a rating or review on the podcasting app of your choice. It helps other people find the podcast, and it makes a big difference. All right, let's talk about some monsters. First up, we have the Troglodyte. Now, I wasn't super impressed by the Troglodyte in the first Monster Manual, I don't think. They suffer a little bit from just being kind of later in the book, by which time you've already run into a bunch of other 1 and 2 HD underground menaces, and there isn't really that much about them that stands out. You know, it's not that there's anything wrong with them, there's just not that much that's new or different about them, and by that point you're looking for something new and different. It was actually in Deities and Demigods that I started to like them a bit more, because the description of their god, Laogzed, is really gross and gives the troglodytes a way to be different from lizard men that actually feels meaningful. Now, in this volume, the troglodytes resemble their counterparts from the Monster Manual, but there are some differences that I think are quite interesting, even though they're not huge. The fundamental premise of the troglodyte is the same. They are lizard people. They live in caves. They're, you know, a bit tougher than like a goblin or whatever. And they emerge from those caves from time to time to raid human settlements and carry people away. Now, if we go back and look at the Monster Manual, we can see that the 70s version of the troglodyte is motivated by, quote, loathing for humans, and they seek to eradicate humankind. But if we look at the Monstrous Manual, we can see that the troglodyte of 2nd edition is a carnivore. They're just meat eaters, and people are among the meat they eat. And it actually says that they often have their lairs near human settlements, not only so that they can capture people and eat them, but so that they can prey on human livestock. So troglodytes just want to eat meat, and if that means grabbing your kindly white-haired granny while she's making her way through the woods to go pick mushrooms, then that's what they'll do. But they'll also steal, like, your pig. They also prize steel. Their description of their technology seems to mostly be stone, so it's not something they can make themselves, and it almost serves as a form of currency within their society. So the 90s version has a much more, like, realistic, I guess, you know, big quotes on that, realistic motivation is grounded in material reality in a way that the 70s version isn't. I don't know that that's necessarily a compliment. I'm going to tell a slightly tangential story. Back in the sort of mid-2000s, or late 2000s, I guess, I ran a campaign of a game called Don't Rest Your Head. Now, Don't Rest Your Head was a bit of an indie sensation at the time. I don't think it's very well known today, but basically it takes place in a kind of dream world of a type that I think was pretty popular in sort of geek media in that era. A place where things are like wacky and surreal and don't necessarily conform to the logic of our world. A sort of mirror mask type of location. And it's meant to be very impressionistic. But as players are put into it, that's not how they experience it, right? They experience it from the perspective of a character, and they experience it from their own perspective. And so they're not going to go along with it's just kind of impressionistic, right? One of the things that they spent a lot of time trying to do was figure out the limits of the setting, figure out what the rules were so that they could use them to, like, trick and overcome their opponents. That is to say that they were in an illogical setting, but they applied logical thinking to it because they're logical people. I think that in a game where you kind of like have to ask the GM's permission to make things true in the world, that kind of impressionistic system is quite hard to do well. So if there's a world where things work by a kind of dream logic, I think it makes sense to give players control, some kind of control anyway, over what happens in that world, because then they can say, I shout an alarm, but the shout comes out of my mouth as a word balloon and then a canary eats it, or whatever, and not have the experience of wanting to do something and then being told, like, no, that doesn't happen. Anyway, that's a side issue. The system thing is not what I'm talking about here. What I'm talking about is the distinction between having a fantastic world and having a naturalistic world. And I feel like the naturalistic world is where these types of games will eventually drift over time, because rulings not rules is, you know, one of the principles of old school fantasy gaming, and it makes sense in a way. Like, I think that is an accurate description, but what happens is that those rulings build up over time into a corpus, and basically sooner or later, players are going to ask questions like, well, what do these troglodytes want? Like, it can't just be that they're evil. Let's talk to this guy. It's not that they're going to be concerned about, like, the physics of the world, but a lot of questions about, like, the economics or the politics of the world are likely to come up. And I don't always think that that has a great effect on games. But I do think that trying to figure out how the world works in a naturalistic sense may over time be inevitable in this type of game. Because players are engaging in a game of action or reaction, they want to know what actions cause what type of reactions. And that could be anything from the physics of the world to the motivations and psychology of their opponents. Now, I hate humans, they must all die, is not a bad or insufficient motivation for an enemy, and I definitely don't want anyone to think that I hold that view, right? I'm not one of those people that thinks, well, all the bad guys have to have realistic motivations. No, they don't. They would only have to have realistic motivations if they were in a realistic setting. And to me, a fantasy setting doesn't have to be realistic. I'm happy with fairy tale-y elements in my games, as long as that is a shared assumption among all the people at the table. So it's not that I hate humans, they must die is a bad or insufficient motivation, but it is a motivation from a very different kind of aesthetic than people are among the meat we eat, and also we do robberies for profit. And second edition has chosen that second aesthetic. Things are grounded. The majority of monsters that you're going to encounter are biological creatures. They live in a biological world. They have ecologies. We learn about their reproductive cycles, and they act for reasons of gain or ideology that are comprehensible to an outsider. What do the goblins get out of it is not a question that you would ask about a typical fairy tale. But I do wonder if that choice in second edition was ever explicit, or if that is just the way the game drifted to that kind of naturalistic mode. We've seen a lot of first edition writings that have that, like, naturalistic quality about them, so I don't think it's an abrupt change. Anyway, troglodytes are fine, but they raised what I thought was an interesting example of this different approach, even if it's only a very slight difference between the two entries. Also, good illustration by Tony DiTerlizzi, although, again, it goes some way toward making the monsters a little more sympathetic. I don't know, they just look cooler when they're drawn by DiTerlizzi than when they're drawn by Dave Sutherland. Next up, we have trolls. There are 8 kinds of them in this 3-page entry: regular, two-headed, freshwater, saltwater, desert, spectral, giant, and ice. Of these, most have previously appeared in first edition, and I'm not going to go into them. The only one that is new is the desert troll, which I assume is an Alcadim thing. The desert troll is basically more or less a regular troll, but it lives, get this, in a desert. Sort of the key thing about the desert troll is that it is not harmed by fire, right? Most trolls take special damage from fire. They can't regenerate damage from fire. The desert troll doesn't regenerate damage from magical fire or breath weapon attacks. It does have a fire weakness, but its main thing is that it takes damage from water if it is splashed with water. And you can even, like, really mess one up with a decanter of endless water. And that makes sense, I guess, because this is a desert creature, lives in a desert setting, so you can kind of put the screws on the player characters a little bit by forcing them to use up a valuable resource in order to fight this monster. Trolls, in general, are fine, and this is a list of them, all in the same place, rather than divided across multiple books. Nothing super new or exciting, But, you know, I don't think anyone complained that there was a problem with trolls before. Indeed, if there was a problem with trolls before, it was the proliferation of all of these subtypes. Freshwater and saltwater trolls? I mean, come on. But they're fine. And this is definitely a good way to include them as merely two among a large group of different troll types. Alright, that is about all the monsters that we have time for today. In our next episode, we're going to be taking a look at some monsters who originated in the pulp fiction of the 1940s, and how we can make them work for modern audiences. I'm talking about the Darrow. So please join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@Dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.